available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello and welcome to Outlook. I'm Stella Roberts and this edition is being recorded on Wednesday the 24th of April 2024. Coming up, we explore the history of a Warwickshire village with Elaine and reminisce about the Pink Panthers 1960s film series with Keith. Nigel has been investigating the crazy world of giant veg, and Bill introduces us to a new way of learning history via social media platform TikTok. We hear about a year in the life of a wildcat, read by Elaine. And lastly, we accompany Dave and Graham on a trip to the Grand Central Steam Railway, Loughborough. That's Great Central Steam Railway. There's also all our usual features, news from the Resource Centre, sport and postbag. But firstly, let's review the past week's news with our readers Peter and Elaine.
News.
Coventry Building Society is poised to acquire the Cooperative Bank in a huge expansion. The move would catapult Coventry Building Society to the position of the UK's seventh largest lender, boasting assets of approximately £89 billion. This acquisition would restore the 152-year-old bank to mutual ownership, the firm says. It would offer around 3 million co-op bank customers the opportunity to become members of the society. At the upcoming AGM in Coventry tomorrow, Thursday the 25th of April, Coventry's board plans to lay out the rationale behind the potential deal and address any queries from its members. In a communication dispatched to over 2 million members of Coventry Building Society, Chief Executive Steve Hughes expressed his enthusiasm. "This is an exciting moment for the society. We have a very successful history, and we believe this could be the basis of a very successful future, with membership, great value, and great service at its heart." He added, "We've spent a lot of time evaluating this opportunity and believe it's the right thing to do. The Cooperative Bank is a financially stable, profitable organisation with a shared heritage, products and services that complement our own."
A leading trade union has claimed that Coventry City Council retracted two offers made to bin workers amid the ongoing row over working conditions. Staff will be sacked in the coming weeks as part of plans for them to be fired and rehired. Negotiations have been taking place in recent months after it was revealed that staff were going to have their existing contracts terminated. Workers, it is alleged, have been offered new contracts which have been described as inferior. The trade union Unite has now claimed that the council made two offers which they later withdrew in a letter. Unite also questioned the stance of the council on people being fired and rehired. A letter penned by Onay Kassab says, "We have the paperwork to show that management made an offer to settle the dispute and that this was based on amending the agreement made in 2022. Unite offered to reach an agreement based on that offer. Management then withdrew its own offer, claiming that there were legal issues. Why would managers make an offer without checking the legal position first?" Mr. Kassab added, "Management then made a further formal offer to replace the first offer, now based on contractual overtime for working on a Saturday and withdrawing the task and finish arrangements from contracts. Once again, Unite offered to settle based on this offer, but this too was withdrawn by the employer in favour of imposing new contracts through fire and rehire." Councillor Patricia Heatherton, Cabinet Member for City Services, said, "The council is looking to modernise the existing service and is looking to make one change to the contract by which they are employed. That one change means that crews work all the hours that they are contracted to work. All of the other terms and conditions, such as pay, Annual leave, sickness pay and a four-day week remain the same, and the service remains in-house. She continued, I understand that more than 70% of the service has already signed the revised contract with that one change. It means that they can keep the many benefits they currently enjoy from working for the council that they could potentially lose if the service was outsourced, something we do not want to see.
WASPI campaigners or Women Against State Pension Injustice, who are fighting for pension justice for women, have been dealt a blow as the bill concerning DWP compensation has been delayed. The proposed legislation, which aims to establish a compensation scheme for WASPI women, was initially set for its second reading in Parliament last week. However, it has now been pushed back to May the 17th. SNP MP Alan Brown voiced his frustration over the delay, stating, I am disappointed that I have had to reschedule the potential second reading of the bill. This is proof that the way Westminster operates with the government of the day, being able to dictate timings, needs to be overhauled. Mr. Brown, who is championing the bill following the DWP's instruction to compensate women affected by past pension changes, commented, Like so many injustices created by Westminster, the lack of resolution for the 3.8 WASPI women is a disgrace. He drew attention to the plight of the 3.8 million women who were abruptly informed that their state pension age would rise from 60 to 66 just before retirement, leaving them without sufficient time for financial planning. For 9 years this place has debated the matter, hearing harrowing individual stories with many MPs from across the chamber pledging they would do all they could to help these women. But for 9 years the government have ignored the plight of those women. We know that this is an injustice, and indeed the Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman judged as far back as July 2021 that the Department for Work and Pensions was guilty of maladministration due to lack of direct communication. Yet here we are, still fighting for compensation.
There are public concerns about the rising amount of money Coventry Council receives from bus lanes. On April the 11th at a scrutiny meeting, Councillor Ed Ruane questioned just how efficient the measures are after data showed that the number of citywide bus lane fines soared by almost two-thirds last year. According to a Freedom of Information request from 2022, bus lane penalties earned the council almost £800,000 in a single year. Councillor Ruane is concerned that bus lane fines are continuing to rise sharply, with fines now making up 45% of tickets issued by the council last year. 41,000 penalty charges for bus lane use were handed out in 2023-24, compared with 25,000 the year before. Local parking manager Paul Bowman, however, sees it as a problem with compliance levels. All limitations are suitably signed, but there seem to be many other areas in the city where limitations are not strictly policed. And he goes on to claim that not imposing fines would lead to traffic congestion. One Coventrian highlighted that the threat of fines affects footfall in the city centre, which is why a lot of people no longer bother going there. Another agrees, We stay away from the city centre and use business parks instead. It's just getting too confusing for older motorists. The 7 dedicated bus lanes in the city are enforced by automatic cameras, and drivers who use the lanes against the rules are hit with a £70 fine, down to £35 if paid within 14 days.
The rebirth of Nuneaton's historic football club has been confirmed by officials. Just months after the collapse of Nuneaton Borough FC, there is the dawn of a new era for football in the town, because last Thursday Nuneaton Town FC was incorporated as a registered community interest company. It means all the new football club is waiting for is to find out from the Football Association which level the team will play at. It is already known that the team will play at the Oval, the home of Bedworth United FC, until a permanent home in Nuneaton can be found. Behind the CIC is a steering group with Jim Evans, a long-time Borough fan and one of the club's new directors, urging people to get behind the new Borough, saying, "The club you've supported all your life has withdrawn from the league and has no manager, no players and no ground. So what do you do? Accept that it's the end of 130 years of the town's proud footballing heritage? No chance. As fans all over the country have done in similar circumstances, you come together as a fan base, as a community, and you rebuild. This is the start of the journey. We want you to come along with us." The steering group is in the process of recruiting a new manager and arranging pre-season friendlies, while the wider fan and club community has helped select a club badge and kit. It already has a board of directors.
If you're about to have tea, you may want to pause this news, have the tea, and then come back to this item. Midlands Water Company, Severn Trent, are urging everyone to work together to help tackle the thousands of blockages they have to deal with. In the past year, water crews at the company have managed and cleared an astonishing 28,782 blockages, something they feel could be avoided if, for example, wet wipes were put in the bin rather than down the toilet and sink. To get people thinking about what should and shouldn't be put down the toilet and sink, Severn Trent is launching Sewer Stories, showcasing the work of waste teams and some of the weird things found in the sewers, including false teeth and car tyres. One of the biggest offenders of blockages, though, is wet wipes. Even some which say flushable or biodegradable on the packaging don't actually break down like toilet paper. In fact, instead, they cause massive issues when flushed, including blockages that back up and cause sewage to flood into homes. Other culprits for causing blockages are kitchen roll, cotton buds, nappies and sanitary products. When all these are congealed together with fats, oils and greases, which also shouldn't be put down the sink, they create fatbergs. So everyone is now being asked to be a binner, not a blocker, in order not to fall foul of a blockage and have a very expensive mess to clear up. Grant Mitchell, yes, sewer blockages lead at Severn Trent, said, "We are reminding everyone not to put anything down the toilet other than the three P's. That's pee, poo and paper. We're working hard to keep the sewers clear and in the best possible working order. And by working together and only putting these three things down the toilet, it will greatly improve sewer health, which will keep everyone protected from the unnecessary hassle of blockages."
A Coventry woman who helped raise £2 million for a cancer charity has been given a national award for her success. Marilyn Haddon, of 68, from Eastern Green, was named a Cancer Research UK Honorary Fellow, in appreciation of her exceptional loyalty and dedication to the cause. The Cancer Research UK annual Flame of Hope Awards acknowledge remarkable efforts in volunteering made by people from all walks of life. And 2024 marks 21 years of the recognition programme. Marilyn, known as Mal, runs the Coventry Local Committee and took on the roles of chairman, secretary and treasurer when the group faced closure 20 years ago. She picked up the Flame of Hope Award at a ceremony in Nottingham, presented by Julie Byard and Emma Hallis from Cancer Research UK. An audience at Colwith Hall heard how Mal, who raises most of the money from collections and craft sales, joined the committee following the death of her mother from esophageal cancer in 1994. Since then, she has been a loyal supporter of Cancer Research UK for over 29 years, showing enormous determination and motivation to beat cancer. Mal said, I started fundraising after I lost my mum to cancer in 1994. I never really had an amount in mind, but wanted to raise money for research, as I didn't want any other family to have to go through what we went through with my mum. It was lovely to receive the Flame of Hope Award. I don't raise money for recognition, I just want to help other people, but it was nice to be recognised. Cancer Research UK Relationship Manager for Coventry and Warwickshire, Ryan Good, who nominated Mal for the award, said, "Without Mal, we simply would not be able to do what we do here. She has enormous determination and motivation running through her veins and shares our ambition to beat cancer." Cancer Research UK's Chief Executive, Michelle Mitchell, said, "Thanks to the dedication of more than 20,000 volunteers supporting us right across the charity, from keeping our shops running to helping us operate many of our outdoor events and so much more, Cancer Research UK has been at the heart of progress that has seen cancer survival in the UK double over the past 40 years.
Morrison's is rewarding customers who've shopped with them in the last 12 months by launching a new loyalty scheme feature that could help shoppers save even more. The supermarket is currently testing its My Points Boosters. This initiative offers personalised challenges to customers, tailoring these based on individual shopping habits. Shoppers can choose up to 10 preferred brands from a customised list and earn loyalty points by hitting specific spending targets within a certain period. Morrison's More Card holders are seeing record levels of rewards as the store continues to find innovative ways to reward its patrons and provide brands with fresh opportunities to connect with their customer base. The tailored recommendations draw from your transaction history over the past year, presenting you with 20 unique offers. And then you select from these 20 offers to activate up to 10. The more you buy of these 10 selected brands or categories throughout the My Points Booster period, the more points that you can earn.
Coventry's Food Bankathon is returning for a second year, with the founder of the city's food banks embarking on a 9-hour walk to raise cash for the service. Canon Gavin Kibble will stop at all of the city's 15 food bank centres on his 34-kilometre journey across the city. He is inviting members of the public to join him on all or part of the route on Bank Holiday Monday, May the 6th. The Food Bankathon will start at the most westerly food bank in Canley, ending at St Catherine's Church in Stoke Aldermore. Individuals and businesses are also being invited to sponsor the initiative, with organisers hoping to beat last year's total of over 5,000. Canon Kibble said, "This year we want to go even bigger with a larger team, walking, running or even skipping the route, with an aim to raise even more money to support the food bank. Please come and join me for one or two segments of the route, or if you're really up for it, the full 34 kilometres. Or just join us en route and take some photos to help raise awareness." Over 250,000 people have received food from the food bank in the 13 years since Canon Kibble founded it, and the cost of living squeeze means that hundreds of people are now using one every week.
Special celebrations were held last Friday to mark the 101st birthday of a proud Coventry woman born and bred in the city. Valerie Handley has seen much that many locals have only ever heard or read about. Valerie was one of five children born to Violet and Bruce McPherson, and she was a teenager through the darkest hours in the city's history, seeing the cathedral after it had been bombed and fire everywhere as she walked to work. Valerie went to Holbrook's Lane School until she was 14, before starting her working life in the accounts department of the former Owen Owen department store, now home to Primark, near to Broadgate and the city's cathedral. During the war, at night, She worked in a communications centre which relayed news about bombs to the emergency services. But she recalled the fateful day when, aged 17, she saw the devastation of the bombings firsthand. She recalled, "On November the 14th, 1940, I went to work as usual. That night there was an air raid. When we came out of the air raid shelter, which was over the road near Whitemore School, our house was okay, but some in the next road were destroyed. There were no buses, so I walked to work. The city centre, including the cathedral, had been destroyed, with fire hoses everywhere, but the firemen couldn't save much. Owen Owen was gone too. The family escaped to Brinklow for a few days before returning home, and Valerie eventually got a job in the personnel department at Courtaulds. It was there that she was to meet the man she went on to marry, Tom Handley, who came from near Ludlow. They started courting, and on April the 20th, 1946, the very day after her 23rd birthday, the pair tied the knot at St. Lawrence's Church in Old Church Road. They lived with her parents and went on to welcome their first daughter, Pamela, in October 1947, and a second daughter a couple of years later. Valerie now lives at Eric Williams' house. It was there that, on her 101st birthday, a special party in her honour was held to mark the milestone.
Doctor Who is heading to Coventry. The cast will appear at Coventry Building Society Arena on Saturday, May the 25th. The BBC TV icons will be there for Comic Con Mania. The event is a celebration of comic book and pop culture, and thousands of fans are expected. Stars from the Harry Potter films are set to headline the one-day event being held in Coventry for the first time, but the Doctor Who legends will also be there. Sylvester McCoy, the seventh Doctor Who, will be at the event and will be joined by Sophie Aldred, who played the seventh Doctor's companion, Ace. Further star quests are set to be announced in the lead-up to the show. The event is set to transform the main exhibition halls at Coventry Building Society Arena into a haven for fans. The family-friendly event is organised by Monopoly Events, the UK's number one fan convention company, and the Coventry show signals an expansion into the West Midlands. David Bradley, who played Filch in Harry Potter, and Walder Frey in Game of Thrones, will be the special guest at the event. And Josh Herdman, best known for playing Gregory Goyle in Harry Potter, will also feature at the arena. Fans will be able to shop for collectibles, comics and more from a selection of over 200 traders at the exhibition. There will also be a cosplay competition and parade with fans invited to come as their favourite characters and compete for the prize of Coventry Cosplay Champion. Organisers will also be building replica sets of popular movies and TV shows for visitors to explore and take photographs. Tickets are free for under fives, £5.50 for children aged 6 to 12, and £11 for age 13 plus.
Outlook News.
Thanks there to our newsreaders, Peter and Elaine. Now, Hugh has joined us in the studio, but just before I hand over to him, here are this week's sunrise and sunset times. It's getting light in the morning from around 5:52 a.m. and the sun is setting at around 8:18 p.m. So, Hugh, what's the latest from the Resource Centre?
What's the latest from the... Last week I promised you some absolutely massive news that I couldn't tell you last week, but which I can tell you this week. The reason for that, there was an embargo on it, very posh, until last Friday. Some of you may have already heard this, but we have been very fortunate to receive a massive grant award. Now, Global is a radio producing organisation, and they run the likes of Classic FM and Heart and LBC and various others. And they have a fund that they call Make Some Noise. So Global's Make Some Noise. And they do big fundraising every autumn. And last year it was in September. And we did a bit of few things for them. I think everybody knew that we were, you know, we were one of the 41, just 41 charities in the whole country that was going to benefit from this year's appeal. Well, they phoned us up a couple of weeks ago and they said, well, we've already awarded you, we'd already awarded you 30-something thousand pounds, but we got so much money last year that we are going to double it. And so you can have it for 2 years. So we are going to be, for the next 2 years, getting, over the course of the next 2 years, getting £72,352, I think it is, for, and this is to cover all the running costs and, for our IT and for devices workshop. So it's a massive, massive boost. What we hope to be able to do is to sort of just extend a few things here and there, but it's a terrific amount of money, and, you know, really good solid funding for the charity over the next 2 years. So what we've promised them is, we said that we will, help around 350 people over the next 2 years to get training and advice on IT and smart tech. I mean, the whole point of this is to help everybody stay connected with the modern world. So much of the modern world is online these days, and a lot of people are recognising that for visually impaired people in particular, you know, using a computer, using a smartphone and a tablet is, you know, has it some very real challenges to it. Now, we know that those challenges can be overcome for the most part, so that's what we're here to help people do. And we are really grateful for this huge boost from Global's Make Some Noise, because we do see every day how people improve, how their skills and confidence get better every day. And so, you know, we're really grateful for them for it. The director of Global Goodness at Global, what a great title that is, director of Global Goodness, is a woman called Suzanne Ryder Richardson. She said it's becoming increasingly hard for small charities to meet the rising demand for their services while struggling with higher bills. They're delivering vital projects which are a lifeline for so many, and we're thrilled that, thanks to the generosity of the global audiences and our partners, we're able to help those charities who are at the centre of communities right across the UK. And, you know, that's absolutely where the position that we're in. So the money's double what we're expecting, so we'll be able to do more for more people. I just have to put a little shout out here as well, because we had the new computers earlier this year as well. So that was from the West Midlands Combined Authority adaptive grant as well. So that's really helped us. So all good, plain sailing, you know, with the wind in our sails, as it were, for the next couple of years with smart tech. So it's a very, very big pot of money for us, and we're very happy indeed to have it. So thank you for them. That's the big piece of news that I wasn't allowed to tell you last week. And you may have known that we had the initial funding, but the big news is that we've now got double it, so that's 2 years worth of funding. I had a meeting this morning with the National Showdown people, so you know that we've got the Showdown table that has arrived. That, I'm very pleased to say, I think I told you last week, has been repaired and is beautifully flat now. There is going to be a big sort of national showcase event is going to take place, and we think it's probably going to be on the 29th of June. They've just got to do a few final things. It was going to be the 18th of May, but everybody thought, well, my word, that's coming up fast. So 29th of June, which is a bit better. It gives us all the teams a little time to breathe. This national showcase event, I'm very pleased to say, is more than likely to be taking place in Warwick. So that's very good for us. So we'll be able to go en masse with volunteers and indeed people who want to play. There'll be lots of things happening during the day to get everybody really up to speed with the game and what have you. That doesn't mean to say, though, that we can't play it now, because we can. The table is good to go. So what Chris is going to do is in the next week he will have found a day when we're going to have our own sort of showcase, showdown showcase event. Hopefully, you know, something a bit social as well, so there may be a bit of food involved, and just get people, whoever wants to come along, just to come along, have a go, have a play, and you could be sighted or not sighted, however, you know, whatever, volunteers and service users, whatever, anybody is welcome to come. We're looking for, we've got some people who are interested in refereeing and coaching, which is good because you need a referee. It is a hard and fast game. So anyway, that's coming. So if you're interested in the showdown, I do hope a lot of you are. And honestly, you know, you don't have to be like super fit for this or anything. You know, any, it doesn't matter whether you can see anything or not because you play blindfolded anyway.
Everybody
plays blindfolded. Oh. It's a completely level playing field.
Okay.
Now the surface has been stuck down.
Right.
Everybody can play. So I think it'll be a great thing for us all. So if you're interested in getting into the showdown thing, really do let Chris know. Give us a call on 024-7671-7522. Press option number 2, that'll take you through to Chris, and if he's not there, you can leave a message and say, Chris, I really want to be part of the showdown. Also leave your name so that he knows who you are, and that would be fantastic. Now, Tuesday just gone, we said goodbye to one of our very long-standing volunteers, the wonderful Roy Enderby. I say goodbye. We said goodbye to him on Tuesdays. Roy has been with the charity for the last 8 years, or at least, I should think, and has been very involved with the devices workshop, and particularly with the IT in the afternoon on Tuesdays. Roy has had a fairly significant birthday. We're just about that point at the moment. He's decided the time is ripe to spend a bit more time with his remaining teeth, I think is the phrase, isn't it? Or, you know, for pipe and slippers, that sort of thing. So he's stepped back from being with us on Tuesdays. We were able to have a really big card for him and give him a bottle of wine to say thank you so much. He's been an exemplary volunteer for the charity. He's helped so many people over so long, just been a terrific help, you know, also to the staff and other volunteers. So thank you, Roy, for that, for all your time that you spent here with us. I'm very pleased to say that he's still carrying on and playing bowls on a Friday morning, which is terrific news. But for him here at the centre, oh, that's it. But anyway, we couldn't be prouder of all of our volunteers, you know, and it's just, you know, for somebody who's given so much, it's a pleasure to be able to mark it. Now, coming up on the 10th of May, so that's a week on Friday, 2 weeks on Friday. Some of you may know, I think, because we advertised this on this programme some while ago, that we have a drama group going at the moment, a 10-week drama group, or 12-week drama group, called Hourglass. And that features a whole bunch of people, including somebody who's sitting here right opposite me, it has to be said, Mr. Peter Huxford, who's part of that group as well. So it's a mixed group of visually impaired and sighted people. So it's called Hourglass Productions. Anyway, they are doing their devised piece on the 10th of May.
And a lot more. Devised piece and several songs with music and movement.
Okay, right, that sounds very entertaining. So Friday, the 10th of May, and that's at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so you don't have to be out late. And that's going to take place at the Albany Social Club. The Albany Social Club is on Ulston Street. It's next door to the Co-op. There are tickets of £5 per person, and children under 5 are free. It's cash only, and you can pay on the door. Yes, I mean, that's where you're paying. You're paying on the door. You're not paying up here at the moment. So please do come along and support it. I'll keep reminding you. If we have enough people that want to go, please mention it to Carl. I'll mention it to Carl as well. And if necessary, we might be able to run a bus for that time. But we'll take a view, depending on how many people from the centre want to come. It would be a really good idea. This is a completely new venture for the charity to have a performing theatre piece for our visually impaired and sighted volunteers. So if you want to have a go at coming along, seeing how what they've got up to for the last 10 weeks, you should definitely come and see that. It'll be a lot of fun, I know. So, that's it, I think, for this week. If I can think of anything else, I'll let you know next week.
Many thanks, Hugh, for all that information. Now it's time to go over to Sarah with this week's sport. She begins by telling us how proud she is after the City's heroic battle with Manchester United.
Well, hello there, listeners. And yes, I did survive the alpacas. And it was lovely to meet many of you on that trip. Now, I'm going to start with a bit of a difference, because normally I too write a script, believe it or not, for sport. Not a precise word-by-word script, but a sort of agenda of points. But today I'm going to start by talking literally ad lib from the heart. Now, unless you were down a cave in Outer Mongolia, you would probably be aware that Coventry City took on the mighty Manchester United in the semi-finals of the FA Cup at Wembley and sadly lost on penalties. So the journey stops there. But I would just like to say now, I am immensely proud of my club. We put up a heck of a fight. In fact, to read the BBC website, the Manchester United managers describing it as they got away with it. BBC themselves are saying it's a semi-final that will be talked about for years to come. So, what more can you say? Well, I'm going to say quite a bit, actually, as you would probably imagine. Now, I think by about the 50th minute, all City fans were getting a bit worried. Oh, it's going to be a cricket score against us. Because by that time, Manchester United had scored 3 times. But then, on the 71st minute, Ellis Sims scored 3-1. Oh well, we've got our consolation goal. The fans who are in Wembley, lucky people, have had a chance to see a goal. Yeah, that's not so bad. We can cope with 3-1. But then, on the 79th minute, Callum O'Hare also scored. Oh gosh, could this really be happening? And cue a bit of excitement, you know. Is this going to be a sort of final push for a City return? Well, it was actually, because in the 5th minute of injury time, City were awarded a penalty. And up steps Mr. Wright, Mr. Hadji Wright, to give him his full name, scores 3-3 at the end of full time. So, there then beckons 30 minutes of extra time. Now, my main worry at that stage was how would our lads cope with it? Because the Premiership, which Manchester United play in, do play at a faster pace than the Championship, where City are. But I needn't have worried, because the ones who were pulling up lame and with cramp, etc., etc., were all the international stars of Manchester United. And I have to say, when you heard their team sheet, it was just cheek by jowl of international players. And I'll just say this now, because I want to get this point in. At one stage, the commentary was made that Onana, no, not banana, Onana, the Manchester United goalkeeper, had cost $43 million, and one of their strikers, Casemiro, $65 million. $43 million for a goalie! My gosh, we signed our goalie from Barnsley, and I bet $43 million would buy two Coventry cities. Just crazy money. Anyway, we really thought our dreams had come. And this was the one bit that left us a bit of a sour note. Because on the very last minute of extra time, Hadji Wright passed to Victor Thorpe, who scored. Absolutely amazing. Another City finish. That would have been 4-3, but sadly it was ruled out by VAR. Oh well. Anyway, overall, I am tremendously proud of my club. Play up, Sky Blues. Okay, eulogy over. So returning to my scripted agenda, but carrying on with the round ball and keeping it local, I'm pleased to report that Leamington drew 1-1 away to Leyton and still remain in the playoff zone. However, sadly, Stratford slipped out of the playoff zone with a defeat at home to Bromsgrove. Oh well, lads, I think you've got one more game to make it right, but I might be wrong. Still, never mind, you've both done very well. Now, Coventry Rugby Club, meanwhile, played Bedford Blues and knew before the match that they could go top of the championship if results went the right way. And it started really promisingly. And at one stage, Cov were leading Bedford 12-0. However, by half time, they'd been pegged back to 12 all. And sadly, in the second half, things got much worse. Well, they got much worse if you're a Bedford fan, that is. With Coventry running out victors 52 points to 19. For info, they're still second, because obviously, and sadly, the leaders, Ealing Trailfinders, also won. Still, what a turnaround for our club. On Saturday coming, that is the 27th, it's the final matches of the Women's Six Nations rugby tournament, with a rather tasty match between France and England in Bordeaux. At the moment, both teams have won all of their matches, although technically England lead by 1 point. Well, not technically, they do lead by 1 point. However, England have come straight off the back of a thrashing of Ireland, 88 points to 10, and are the favourites to retain the Grand Slam. If you want to watch this match, it's on BBC One on Saturday the 27th, with a programme starting at 4 and kick-off at 4:45. Come on, ladies, you can do it! Now, one bit of sort of sad but almost expected gymnastics news is that Max Whitlock, age 31, has announced that he will be retiring from gymnastics after the Paris Olympics. He explained that he's basically given 24 of these 31 years on this planet to gymnastics. And I think he wants to do something else, like enjoy his family, and not, no doubt, have to spend about 10 hours a day in the gym. also Paris bound are our two marathon runners, Emil Keres and Mohamed Mohamed, who finished third and fourth respectively at the London Marathon and ran qualifying times for the Olympics. So well done, lads. Oh, and by the way, no one's finished that high in the Olympics since Mo Farah, and we all know what Mo went on to do at the Olympics. And finally, but continuing the Olympic theme, and I'm afraid you'll find a lot of this over the next few weeks, because there are only 93 days to go. The Olympic flame was ignited last week at the birthplace of the Olympic Games in Greece. Traditionally, it's ignited from rays of the sun with a sort of group of women dressed in floaty things, don't stand too near the flames, ladies, dancing and swirling around. But this year, you will not be surprised to hear, there was too much cloud cover to use the rays of the sun, so they had to use a lighter. Oh well, it's lit and it's now beginning its journey to Paris. And that has been your sport for the week. Have fun. Bye.
Sounded like a lovely day out, Dave and Graham, and you got to meet Ruffle the Rail Dog. That was the last item in today's programme, so it's goodbye from me, Stella Roberts, and from all the team until next time. Outlook will be back next week. And now on to Dave with your postbag.
Hello and welcome to your postbag. Thank you first of all to Tina for sending me one of your lovely handmade Easter cards. I really appreciate your kindness. And now a big get well soon to Julia. I was sad that you'd lost your voice, and I hope you're better soon. And it's so nice your friend John stands in for you when you're not at your English stroke computer lessons. Here he is with his report entitled, Stood Up Again. I used to get stood up regularly when I was a teenager in the 60s. I thought by the time I was approaching my 80s, those days would cease. Not so. My friend Julia's not well. I hope she gets better soon. I miss her. I told her to lay off the gin, but will she listen? It's sad, really. But anyway, let's all wish her well. And there are some excellent organisations that are dedicated to helping members combat bad habits. But once again, it falls to me to fill a Julia-sized hole in postbag. I went to the Criterion last Saturday to assist in launching the Creative Writing Group's foray into audio recording. They had their book, Who Turned Out the Lights, professionally recorded by actors from the Criterion and recorded at Powerhouse Studios. It should be understood that my only involvement with this launch was to buy a pint or two at the bar and hang around looking pretty. But the audio recordings, available in many formats, see Heather at reception, are so good that every home should have one. The launch at the Criterion was a very well handled and consisted of an invited audience of VIPs. Fortunately, they left the back door open, so I got in too. I think that must be the way Vic Minette, BBC, and the Deputy Mayor gained entry as well. The whole extravaganza was presided over by the very lovely Uncle Hugh and Auntie Jessica. And I can't finish off a review without mentioning our very own media tart, the Cuddly Derek. As my friend Edwina would say, I'll draw to a close now, but not without restating that my friends Jill and Mike Lane are still suffering from a medical emergency and urgently require both a nursing home close to Ilston or a hospital-style bed. I hope my friend Julia sobers up and comes back next week. Lots of love, Julia's friend John. Thank you very much, John, for standing in for Julia. Jill and Mike might like to inquire about Belvedere Nursing Home in Ilston, overlooking Spencer Park. My late brother-in-law, Martin Richards, whose funeral was on the 18th of April, was going to move into the Belvedere Nursing Home, overlooking Spencer Park, Ilston, but he was taken into hospital, where he died. His wife, my sister-in-law Tonya, said what a lovely place it was, and the family was happy about him going there. Anyway, best wishes to Mike and Jill. The social services loaned Sheila a hospital bed with an air control mattress for relieving pressure sores. She first had a mobile phone and then a doorbell in her bed to call me if she needed help. And there were lots of copies of the CD at the Resource Centre for £5, and I bought a copy, and it's really good. I was so pleased that some members of the creative writing group, past and present, whose writings were on the album, have given me their pieces to read out in Postbag, including the very present Derek Headley. One recent article read by the actress is by Edwina. We are privileged, though, to hear her voice and personality in Postbag. Here she is talking about spring fashion colours.
Hi, everybody, it's Edwina. Today, going to concentrate a bit on colours. Spring really is here. There's lots of colour around us in the garden. And if we have got some sight, we can enjoy all the colours. Colours make such a difference to life. This is why it's important to look after yourself and think about what colours you wear. I do. I try to match things up and wear different scarves. It all makes a difference and you get the feel-good factor. The list of the colours for 2024, if I can just remember. Right, here we go then. There is baby blue, orange, red, silver. There's no purple, there's no green, there's no pinks. So, if you have a lot of those colours, you can take turns with some of the clothes in the latest colours. I think brown is nice, and I would always put pink. So I have several pink sweaters and blouses, and I can have a brown skirt or brown trousers. I don't wear trousers, I like long skirts best. Velvet ones at the moment to keep warm. So, there is a variation of colours that will be in the shops and you can take your choice and pick a colour you like. Purple is my favourite colour, but it's very rarely seen now. They've moved on in fashion. I don't know about me. I try to be an in-betweeny because I'm not young and I don't think old yet. So keep smiling. Take care. Bye.
Thank you, Edwina. And also Amy, who is also on the CD, who put out the lights. Here she is with a lovely voice to tell you about her YouTube channel.
Saturday the 6th of April, my YouTube channel and also Facebook page were both launched. This is something I've been working on with Ian Lachlan plus Vicky Stevenson, who's the artistic director. She's actually the artistic director of the pantomime, but she's been like the artist. together, the Sugar's Well Studios near Bunbury. We recorded these poems. I should mention that his wife, Eileen's a poet, and she's been helping me with this project too. She recorded them along with the actress, myself and Ian. And I kept this project a secret for 2 years, basically. I didn't tell anybody, not even my mum and dad. The only person in my family that knew about it was my brother Stuart. And there's a very good reason why he knew about it. He kind of suggested it in the first place. He said what it needed was one or two celebrities to record my poems. And I was talking to him on the phone one day, and I decided to ask Ian, and Ian said yes, and it all stemmed from there, really.
And Amy's YouTube channel is lovely, with the introductions and some poems read by her and Coventry's pantomime dame Ian Lachlan and other poets. It's added to every Friday. Either go into Amy Clennell on YouTube, that's Clennell, CLENNELL, or ask somebody to help you. Now finally, Graham Whale's friend Ian Harris asked me what visually impaired people prefer to use, a debit card or cash. Before I had chance to ask the question, here's Graham with his experiences.
Interesting to hear the item on plastic money versus cash on Outlook this week. I have a Visa card, a debit card, which I find I'm using more and more these days, especially with contact payment. It is so convenient. But at the same time, I still couldn't do without cash. I occasionally need to travel on the bus before 9:30 in the morning, in which I need cash. There are several ways you can buy your fare now on the bus, and I wouldn't be surprised if you could use cashless payment with a card. But you will be required to put a PIN number in occasionally, because the banks insist on this for security reasons. Every so many transactions, you have to put your PIN number in. And I would hate that to happen just as I'm using the card on a bus. I don't know whether they've got an accessible keypad. I have no idea. I intend to pay or buy cash when I board a bus before 9:30 in the morning. Also, you have traders to the house to do jobs who won't take card payments. Some of them will take bank transfers, but a lot of them just will only take cash. So you still need cash. You can't do without it. You might go to a restaurant where you want to share the bill between you. So you have to need cash to juggle around and, you know, come to the right amount. And so, you know, you can't do without cash, but at the same time, I couldn't do without the bank card now. Regarding the, well, you says green bin, but I think you'll find it's a brown-lidded bin in this area. You obviously doesn't live in Coventry. But I thought we were going to be notified of the procedure, which I haven't heard anything. So this morning, it was this morning actually, only this morning, I thought I'd ring up and find out. And I was able to get through to the right person, and I was able to do the business there and then. No idea whether I should need the bin at the moment this year, but I'm registering it just in case. I mean, it's only £40. It's not going to break the bank, honestly. It's only £40, but of course, it could go up next year and the year after. I suspect it probably will.
So, card or cash, which do you prefer using? More from Graham next time on the subject of water meters. Will you save money with one if you live by yourself or maybe one or two people in the household? Graham certainly does. We'll find out more. Thank you for your messages this week. Please let's hear from you next time. Bye for now.
Thanks there to Dave, as always, bringing you your postbag. Our first special feature this week is about Alderminster. We trace the long history of a Warwickshire village, read by Elaine.
Standing astride the busy 3400 Stratford to Oxford Road, Alderminster must be a familiar sight to the many travellers who pass through at speed. The church was founded by a community of monks led by St. Aegis and sent from Glastonbury in AD 530. After his death in 582, his shrine was a place of pilgrimage until suppressed by the Archbishop of Canterbury in 673. The community was taken over by Malmesbury Abbey, then Pershore Abbey, who made it a house for maintenance of hospitality and for infirm monks. At the same time, an extension was made for a parish church of the Holy Cross and High Altar of St. Mary Minster Chancel, dedicated on the 14th of July 1286 by the Lord Bishop of Worcester. The main part of the village was then at the top of the hill to the north-east, but in 1348 the Black Death wiped out most of the inhabitants, and those remaining grouped their homes near the church. During the Civil War in 1642, Cromwellian troops were stationed in the village before the Battle of Edge Hill. While renovation was going on in one of the older houses, a walled-up body was found wearing a roundhead breastplate. In 1823, it was decided to build a tramway between Stratford-upon-Avon and Moreton-in-the-Marsh, following the main road through Alderminster. A bridge was built over the Avon, and the road at Alderminster was straightened, so that it only had one track to cross. The day of opening, the 5th of September 1826, saw a crowd of thousands and celebrations at Moreton. As there were several hills on the way, and horses were used to pull the tram, a halt was called at the top while the horse was unhitched and placed on the tram. The brake was released and then the whole load careered downhill to the bottom, where normal transport was resumed. The tramway was closed by the GWR in 1869. During the 1870s, a local landowner built 24 houses, the school and schoolhouse in the village. The school, which opened in 1872, was in use until 1971. Such a shame it didn't reach 100. When, due to the retirement of the two teachers, it was closed. It is now a private house. In 1960, about 100 houses were spread along the main road, with a garage, post office cum store, bakery and the Bell Inn. An ex-army hut was used as a village hall, but a new hall was built in 1963. Since then, many new houses have been built, and the number of residents has almost doubled. At the same time, the post office cum stores and bakery have both closed. So villagers must visit Newbold or Stratford for pensions, stamps and food.
Still a thriving population after centuries of plague and war, but like so many modern communities, losing its local amenities. Next we take a nostalgic look back to a film series of the 60s and 70s, The Pink Panther. No, not the cool pink-coloured cartoon cat, but a stolen jewel, investigated by a totally incompetent detective, Inspector Clouseau, played by the then little-known Peter Sellers. Keith is the reader.
It was the making of Peter Sellers, but the pudgy Cockney wasn't even first choice to play the hapless Inspector Clouseau in the film. 60 years on, James Moore revisits the chaos that spawned a cult classic. It was the movie that turned Peter Sellers into a global superstar, thanks to his hilarious turn as hapless French detective Inspector Jacques Clouseau. The Pink Panther opened in Britain on the 9th of January 1964 and went on to be a box office hit, spawning a string of sequels and a $1 billion franchise. Critics lauded Sellers as the next Charlie Chaplin, with one critic praising his flawless sense of mistiming. Returning to the role of the potty policeman five times over the years, audiences adored his bumbling antics and hilariously overblown French accent. Only the chameleonic ex-goon could have pulled off pronouncing words like room as room, moth as myth, and monkey as minky with such playful panache. But 60 years on from the original film's release, we can reveal that the now legendary clock comic actor wasn't even supposed to be in the flick, let alone playing the leading character. What's more, the making of the movie and its sequels was a roller coaster of mirth and mania that reflected Sellers' own topsy-turvy personal life. The plot of The Pink Panther, written by Maurice Richlin and its director Blake Edwards, centred around a playboy jewel thief called Sir Charles Lytton, portrayed by David Niven. Nicknamed the Phantom, he sets out to steal a huge pink priceless diamond from Princess Darla, played by Claudia Cardinale. The gem is dubbed the Pink Panther after a tiny flaw that looks like a leaping big cat. Clouseau pursues the Phantom to an Italian ski resort as he tries to unmask the suave villain among a glamorous high society set, while hampered in his efforts by his own duplicitous wife, Simone. Cue comic mayhem and farce, which eventually sees the inspector end up in the frame himself. Originally, Clouseau's character was meant to be played straight and was not the focus of the film. Niven was given top billing and most of the action. It was also Peter Ustinov, later known for playing Agatha Christie's detective Hercule Poirot, who was initially slated to take on the part, with Hollywood beauty Ava Gardner set to play the cuckolded cop's scheming spouse. But Gardner ended up being dropped just weeks before filming began, after a string of diva-like demands that allegedly included insisting on her own private villa, personal chauffeur and chef. Edwards managed to quickly cast little-known French model Capucine as Simone, at the suggestion of her friend Audrey Hepburn, who'd starred in his Oscar-winning movie Breakfast at Tiffany's. Then, at the last minute, Ustinov suddenly pulled out, leaving the American director desperate to find a replacement for Clouseau. He'd barely heard of Sellers, thinking of him as a pudgy cockney, but eventually agreed to cast the upcoming movie star, who'd appeared in British pictures like I'm All Right, Jack and The Millionaires with Sophia Loren. When Sellers arrived in Rome to begin filming, the pair immediately bonded over a shared love of silent comics like Laurel and Hardy and Buster Keaton. They swiftly decided to turn the Clouseau character into a slapstick buffoon. Sellers, paid £90,000 for the role, chose his own costume, establishing his trademark raincoat and hat, and partly based his stance and moustache on a picture from a matchbox of Captain Matthew Webb, the first man to swim the English Channel in 1875. Determined to make his mark, it was said that Sellers took diet pills in a bid to boost his screen sex appeal. Yet whilst he was undoubtedly a master of voices, Edwards had to help Sellers learn how to master the physical comedy, basing Clouseau's pratfalls on his own clumsiness. The talented Brit soon learnt to improvise, and together, using multiple cameras, they would create timeless comedy from simple gags, such as Clouseau leaning on a globe and falling over, to unwittingly stepping on his violin in the dark. If you've seen one Stradivarius, you've seen them all.
That was part one of a two-part piece recalling these hilarious films, so more next time. Next, an unlikely subject for comedy maybe, the theft of giant veg. Here's Nigel to explain in a piece written by Alice Ryan.
The theft of prize marrow plants is an unlikely premise for a movie, but that's the plot of Swede Caroline, a mockumentary about the world of competitive giant veg growing. It's the brainchild of writer Brooke Driver, who, on reading an article about the annual Canna UK National Giant Vegetables Championship at the Malvern Autumn Show, was smitten by the subject. The cast of the film is led by Joe Hartley from Afterlife as the burgled grower, Aveling B from This Way Up, as a private detective paid to find the pinched plants. The innate comedy of dedicating your life to growing the heaviest onion there's ever been, it just gets me. It's totally pointless, yet I can totally see the allure, explains Brooke. I thought having a main character whose goal is to become the first female to get gold in the heaviest marrow division was suitably bizarre. Then I thought, she gets her plants stolen. Among Brooke's advisors on the film was Ken Forty, Mr. Giant Veg to his fans, said to include Snoop Dogg and H.M. the King, who sought his advice on vegetable growing at Highgrove. The holder of 9 Guinness World Records, including tallest potato, would you believe, 6 foot 10 inches, and heaviest sunflower head, 6.5 kilograms, Kevin has vast veggies in his blood. His late father, Mike, is credited with founding the UK Championships in the 80s. Whether you're aimed for a record or a personal best, what motivates growers is nurturing a tiny seed for several months and getting that red card at the championships, explains Kevin, who lives in South Wales. He says interest in the contest increases each year and was given a boost by people growing their own during pandemic lockdowns. Growing giant vegetables helps individuals to challenge themselves and also brings families and communities together, adds Kevin. Southampton flower farmer Ian Payton, who has been growing a giant pumpkins with twin brother Stuart since they were 11, agrees. Everyone in the growing community is very open because at the end of the day, the person you're really competing against is you. It's about inspiring other growers, the next generation. That's one of the great things about pumpkins. They've got the Hogwarts element to them. That really captures the imagination. When you lift them with a crane or a purpose-built cradle, it's a joke, absolutely ridiculous. And that novelty never wears off. We call it the pumpkin sickness. Once you've got it, there's no cure. With their sights set on a new world record weight for Atlantic Giant, their preferred pumpkin variety, at Bournemouth this year on the 27th to 29th September, the Paytons have refined their growing technique over 5 decades. They fitted their glasshouses with reactive sunshades to prevent scorching and an automated hydration system to maintain optimum moisture levels and expect their absolute monsters grow an incredible 70 pounds daily during peak growing season. The current giant pumpkin Guinness World Record is 2,749 pounds or 1,246.9 kilograms, heavier, in fact, than a Nissan Micra, is held by horticultural teacher Travis Geinger in Minnesota. We've beaten it before with the 2,970-pounder, but around day 100, it developed a tiny hole at the blossom end, and so it wasn't eligible, says Ian. Ultimately, I'd like us to be the first to hit the 3,000-pound mark. The giant veg growing scene is treated with affection, he adds. It's not a mockery, it's a celebration of the quirkiness of this part of British life. And fundamentally, it's fun. I don't think we have enough things in life which are just fun.
The quirky world of those with incurable pumpkin sickness. Well, it takes all sorts. And now over to the world of social media platform TikTok, where young Alice Loxton is enthralling audiences with her brief videos showing a passion for the history to be discovered all around us. If, like me, you haven't come across the expression Generation Z, or Gen Zers, it refers to those born between 1997 and 2012. Bill is the reader of the piece. It's written by Jane Warren.
In an age of viral challenges and fleeting online trends, where attention spans are often shorter than a Roman toga, Alice Loxton is captivating a generation with bite-sized bursts of history delivered via social media platform TikTok. Through her handle, history_Alice, she has amassed a following of nearly 750,000 predominantly Generation Z followers, enthralled by her unique and accessible portal to the past. Forget dusty archives and dry lectures that drone on like a bard reciting an epic poem nobody remembers. The 28-year-old has found a way to make history captivating for teenagers and 20-somethings based on short snippets and instant gratification. Her weapon of choice? The very platform that often gets labelled as a breeding ground for mindless clickbait. With her infectious enthusiasm and smartphone at the ready, Alice uses the social media platform to create visually engaging videos lasting between 30 and 120 seconds, revealing historical oddities and architectural curiosities that manage to engage even the most scroll-happy audience. One moment, she's exploring hidden bomb shelters beneath London. The next, she's deciphering symbolism hidden within the architecture of a medieval cathedral, her smartphone panning across weathered stonework. And everything is set to classical music, the most evocative soundtrack there is, she says. I like finding all the quirky, strange things that people see every single day and say, did you know there is this amazing story behind it, Alice says. Since beginning her channel in April 2021, with the story of the biscuit tin that hid the crown jewels at Windsor Castle during the Second World War, 100,000 views and counting, Alice has become one of the UK's youngest and most influential historians, with more than 11 million likes on TikTok and 1.4 million followers on Instagram. I've received messages from students thanking me for making history relatable and exciting. That's truly the most rewarding part of this whole experience, she enthuses. The biggest feedback I get is the overwhelming message, I never realised how much I loved history, or I hated learning history at school, but I love this and found it interesting. I do believe that everyone has an interest in history. We are put off at different stages. But history is the story of everything that's ever happened, and it's all true. So it's even more remarkable. I'm trying to find a way to help people back in. I talk about buildings that people can actually go and see, or architectural details to inform their daily commute. If you know a bit about architectural history, it makes your day even more interesting. Now, her debut book, Uproar, an acclaimed study of the influential political cartoonists of the 18th century, written in her hallmark conversational style, is about to be published in paperback. Her second book, 18, A History of Britain in 18 Young Lives, will be published in August. I've always been into history, and I've always been thrilled by old buildings, she enthuses, her voice ringing with energy. When I go to a historic building, it sends shivers down my spine. But it dawned on me that history wasn't connecting my generation. I wanted to find a way to make history accessible, engaging, and more importantly, fun. We take churches for granted, but in every village there is an 800-year-old building. It's really something quite extraordinary. Churches are in massive crisis, so I want to convince people how wonderful these buildings are and why we need to preserve them. In 1 minute, you can share a lot of information. The impact of her TikToks extends beyond the realm of entertainment. heritage organisations, including the National Trust, who sometimes struggle to attract Generation Z visitors, are reaching out to collaborate with Alice. Set up Young Trust to gather young people together to see what they wanted from the National Trust, and I make content on social media about their properties. There are all sorts of conversations going on, she says.
Encouraging to hear about such a positive use of a social media platform. That was part one of a two-part article and will be concluded next time. And now, wildcats. Keith Ringland has been studying them for many years and wrote an article for Country File magazine in which he imagines a year in the life of a female Scottish wildcat from her point of view. It's read by Elaine.
I deal in death that I haven't eaten in 2 days. There is danger everywhere. It is early May, and as I look onto the expansive rough hill from within my rocky den, I check for enemies of any sort. I listen as well. The gusts of wind unsettle me. It can make detection of my foes and prey more unreliable. If there is an ambush waiting for me, it is likely to come from above and behind my rocky hideaway. I am prepared to wait for hours before I emerge, even though I am hungry. I need to get food tonight, but I won't drop my guard for a second. I am an assassin, one of the best. I know only too well how quickly one little mistake can mean it's all over. After all, I have taken life many times before today, and I have survived by being forever wary. Being very hungry will not change that. I will emerge from my hideaway only when I feel it is safe to do so. Later this month, I will be giving birth to my kittens. I need to be particularly careful, as I do not want to give any clues as to my chosen den site. It consists of a hole in a rocky outcrop, tight to get into, but once in, it flattens out to a low cylindrical gap with a rock floor. I can fend off any attackers at the entrance should anything try to enter. The kitten's arrival is timed to coincide with the proliferation of my prey. Rabbits and voles make up most of my diet, and their naive young are easily caught, meaning I spend less time finding food and being away from the kittens. I move using the land contours to hide my presence, pausing every 20 metres or so to see if there are any unsuspecting rabbits about. If so, I will stalk in with a sudden final rush before killing one. If I detect voles in long, rough grass clumps, I will pounce from above or the side. By the end of June, I allow the kittens out to play, but only with me close by, watching out for eagles or foxes that could snatch one of the youngsters. Now the kittens largely play alone, pouncing on imaginary prey. I move the den site every few days, at first by carrying each kitten, and then, from mid-July, by leading them. From then on, I allow the kittens to play less closely supervised. They enjoy boisterous games where they can and do hurt each other, but the only noises they emit are soft and barely discernible. I bring live voles and young rabbits back to let the kittens improve their hunting skills. By the end of August, they may be hunting by themselves close by the den, catching voles and other small creatures. By the end of September, they will be more competent in the assassin's arts and spread further afield. Every day they become more independent, until eventually they drift away to find their own territory. As winter approaches, prey becomes scarcer, at a time when food and energy is needed most. Soon there will be hard frosts and snow. The deep snow makes hunting difficult, so I change my tactics. I sit above a rabbit hole for many hours, silent and still, looking for that one chance to pounce and catch a meal. But I may have to go without food for days at a time and endure extremely cold nights. I will take fresh carrion in these conditions. By February, the desire to mate begins to build. There is a big male in the next glen, who is the father of this year's kittens. We meet and sit close for a while without touching. When I am ready to mate, I call to him with a chilling, unearthly wail, a noise unlike any other that you will hear in Britain. We mate many times over several days in late February and March. By May, I will have selected my dens, and my year begins again.
A life fraught with danger and hardship. It's not easy being a wildcat. Next, we take a trip with Dave and Graham on board the Great Central Steam Railway at Loughborough. Prepare for a 1940s vibe and a celebration of Dog Day.
Hello there, welcome to the Great Central Railway, Loughborough. And it's Graham that's got the idea to come here. So what brings us here, Graham?
There's a Dog Day.
A Dog Day at the railway.
That's
all right. That sounds intriguing anyway. Okay, well, here's the great beast of an engine. Steam coming from it. Anyway, I'm speaking to the engine driver now. Great stuff. I bet you enjoy your job, don't you?
We do, especially when the weather's a nice night this morning.
Okay. Can you tell us briefly about your engine, please?
This is a BR Standard Class 2 engine, number 78018. We also run at the Great Central the same engine, similar engine, but number 78019. This engine is owned by the Donington Railway Preservation Society, but is looked after by the Loughborough Standard Locomotives Group, who are based here at Loughborough.
Great. Oh yes, I'm speaking to a gentleman here in uniform. What's your job?
Hello, I'm Richard. I'm the station master here today.
Okay.
And I'm helping the passengers get on and off the trains and the children work out what to do with their competition.
Excellent. And there's a special event taking place today, isn't
it? There is. We're promoting a book written by a friend of ours for children called Ruffle the Rail Dog.
Wow.
And there's a performance for children with puppets in the 10-foot form.
That's
so there's something extra for the children, but ordinary passengers are very welcome as well today.
That's great. Okay, right. I'm speaking to a nice lady now. Can you tell me about your dogs, please?
Oh, my dog's getting quite old now. He's 11 this year.
Yeah.
But it's Cockapoo. That's half spaniel, half poodle. But it's a really good dog. He loves his walks and he's so playful and so good for children. And yeah, just happy.
So what's the other dog called?
This dog, he's called Rocco, and he's 12 this year. He's quite old, but he's very, very excited to be on a train for the first time.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and he's a very good boy. He's half sausage dog, half Jack Russell.
Great! Experience the Great Central Railway is a wonderful preserve railway running for 8 miles between Loughborough and Leicester. It was part of the original Great Central Main Line built at the very end of the Victorian age. Looks like we're off.
To get off the next one, yeah.
All right. So when's the next stop, Graham?
Corn and Woodhouse.
Okay. And that's where the show is. We've just arrived in Corn and Woodhouse Station. And there's a sign that says Dig for Victory. There's a sign that says Visit Our 1940s Naffy. Serving tea, coffee, soup, hot chocolate, etc. Okay, right, we're going in the naffy now. Hello there. Hello there. Right, that's a nice greeting for the naffy. Can you tell me about yourself, please? What do you do?
The naffy is the institute, the canteen for the Navy, the Armed Forces,
yeah,
the Air Force. And that's what NAAFI means.
Oh, right.
It's the institute. It's the canteen, basically.
Okay, a canteen.
You get a cup of tea.
Thank you. And it seems to be built in an air raid shelter because it's got a kind of that kind of roof.
We're under the bridge,
yeah.
And it used to be where the Home Guard met.
Yes.
So Dad's Army.
Dad's Army, that's
yes.
Right.
The Home Guard used to meet here and discuss various things of the day.
Okay, right, here's an old-fashioned cash register. Fantastic, Rebecca, thank you.
Oh, well,
there's a change. So what's your name?
Robert.
Okay, you think you can give us some information about the station, please?
Yeah, this is the original station from the 1940s, and it's been kept in the same style as far as we can. So the idea, it's not just the steam experience, you know, you've got the nostalgia, which is why we, as volunteers, we like to work here, because it is a reminder of the way the railway was, not just the steam trains themselves, the actual buildings and everything.
Yeah, a real golden age.
It is a golden age.
Where we are now.
Where we are now is the general waiting room.
Yes.
Pretty much as it was in the 1940s.
Wow.
Right. So originally, this railway is 125 years old. Originally, this would be...
Yes.
The Great Central Railway,
yeah.
Which then became, which went down to Marylebone Station in London.
Yes.
And it came back probably when it became London North Eastern Railway.
Yeah.
And then it was closed by Beeching in the late 1960s.
Oh, yes, yes.
And then, of course, a group of people to save the line,
yeah.
And they raised funds to buy it,
yeah.
In the early 70s, which was the Steam Mainline Steam Preservation Trust,
yeah.
And then it became what it is today, which is Great Central Railway. And our latest exploit is to try and link through to Ruddington near Nottingham.
Yeah, wow.
Well, with the line there, we've made the connection. We're just about to fire it up, all being well. So then it will become an 18-mile heritage railway,
which is
pretty good going. And also, we're the only double-track railway,
really?
So
yes.
You can see steam trains passing each other at the station. So that's that.
Here we are, so where are we now?
This is the booking office.
Booking office.
Where you buy your tickets.
Yes, the
original ticketing system.
Yeah.
The Edmondson ticketing system.
Yes.
So you buy your ticket here to be stamped with the date, which is on this chart here. And then you go on the platform. This, I mean, we've got the original, you know, the old telephones from the, I mean, you and I
recognise
these.
We remember them, yes.
It's a bit of a novelty for the kids growing up these days, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is a typewriter from the era, and interestingly, it's got uppercase and lowercase, so we've got a complete set of uppercase letters,
yes.
And a complete set of lowercase letters.
Yeah.
Which is quite unusual. Obviously, these days, the kids wouldn't have a clue what that was.
No. you've been involved in some TV programmes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we've had Top Gear on, and we had one or two famous films. I can't remember who they are.
What was the episode in Top Gear? Was that the one with the tornado?
I don't remember about that, but they had a Jaguar car, and they put train wheels on it.
Yeah.
Rather than the ordinary rubber tyres and so on, and they smashed it up, but I think it was all...
Effect. All parts of the act.
It was. Excellent.
Well, the Great Central Railway is thanks to a Victorian engineer called Sir Edward Watkin, and he was responsible for the start of the Canadian Pacific Railroad, and then he tried to build a version of the Eiffel Tower on what now is Wembley Stadium. He dug 2 miles of the Channel Tunnel and then developed the Great Central Railway. Well, we're about to go and listen to some stories about Ruffle the Dog by Rachel Greaves.
Come on, play with me. Ruff, 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 ruffle, I wonder what we'll see.
Go!
Ruff, 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 ruffle, come on, stay with me.
Oh!
Well, we've just been enjoying some stories about Ruffles the Rail Dog by author Rachel Greaves. So this is roughly. You have something interesting about this station?
Colin Baker and Nicola Bryant filmed at this station, like a low budget film or TV. Not really, it wasn't a TV film, no, it was like a low budget fan film thing.
That's right, it was called The Stranger.
The Stranger, yeah.
I believe, yes. And stars of Doctor Who took part in it for the fans. Going from left to north back to Loughborough. And we've just had a breakfast on board the train, which was really nice, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And we've just arrived at Loughborough Station. Well, it's been a fantastic day out with the Great Central Railway. Thanks, Graham, for suggesting it.
It's been great, yeah.
It has. We really enjoyed it, haven't we? It's been fantastic. Thank you. That's all from Loughborough Station on the Great Central Railway from me, Dave Monks, and from Graham. Bye.
Sounded like a lovely day out, Dave and Graham. And you got to meet Ruffle the Rail Dog. That was the last item in today's programme, so it's goodbye from me, Stella Roberts, and from all the team until next time. Outlook will be back next week.